In our last podcast, you heard part one of a conversation that I had with Scott Stripling, who is provost and archaeologist at the Bible Seminary in the Houston area. Scott has been digging around in Israel for 20 years, and he's come up with some amazing things. In this particular podcast, he's leading me through the second half of the 3J exhibit. Now, 3J stands for Joshua, Judges, and Jesus. We're going to pick up where we left off next on the Stone Chapel. Scott, we've arrived in the world of Jesus, Roman Judea, Roman gods. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in this period, right? Very different than Iron Age One.
Yeah, so when the Jews achieved independence with the Maccabeans, that lasted about 100 years. And then the Seleucids, once again, were trying to overtake them, and they made a big mistake. They appealed to this new world power called Rome. And when Rome sent Pompey in 63 B.C., the Romans never left. The camel's head is in the tent at that point. Yeah. So in Malachi, everything's fine. We're an independent nation. And then you open Matthew, and now the Romans are in charge. That's how it happens. Come in by invitation. And there's two realities that are important. One is the Greco-Roman reality. Like in Acts 14, why did they confuse Paul and Barnabas with Zeus and Hermes? You know, so right. Who are Zeus and Hermes? Right. You know, we need to think about that. And then the reforms within Second Temple period Judaism, like where do Pharisees and Sadducees come from, and ritual purity and all these things that are so big in the New Testament. Mm. So here we have some Greco-Roman gods. Okay, these are on loan, from the Horn Museum. Yeah. And so these were not excavated at our site.
Very different kind of lamp, facial features here on these gods and goddesses. It looks like Tychicke, Fortuna, and Juno.
The month of June is named after her.
Oh.
Okay, so Roman name Hera. She's the wife of Zeus. Greek name is Hera. Roman name is Juno, goddess of marriage. That's why you have more marriages in June than other months. You know, so her blessing is on it. And our months of the year still come from these pagan gods. We're in March right now. Well, that's Mars. Hmm. The days of the week all go back into these pagan times too. But think of Zeus. Zeus is the head of their pantheon, Jupiter in Latin. And he is a liar, a thief, a murderer, and a rapist.
Now, not a good guy.
No. And he's the head of your pantheon of gods. Now, this is what the apostles are encountering when they're taking the gospel. No wonder we read about the immorality, the amorality issues of the first century world when your gods are
behaving that way.
Then same thing with you've got Dionysus, the god of alcohol and theater arts, and sort of like Mardi Gras,
Mardi Gras all the time.
Mardi Gras all the time in Dionysus' world. Mm. So they associated consumption of alcohol with infilling of the spirit, because when they drank, they felt that inebriation as if they were being filled by the spirit of Dionysus. Mm. And on the day of Pentecost, isn't it interesting that that's the first thing the crowd says? These guys are drunk.
It's 9 o'clock in the morning. No, it's too early.
Yeah, it helps us. Here's Athena, and Paul, of course, was in front of the Parthenon when he made his famous statement, God does not dwell in buildings built by human hands. And so that's her temple. That was a pretty courageous statement that he made.
That was. Now, who designed the exhibit here?
Okay, so I designed it, and Jordan McClinton is my co-director of the exhibit. And so our whole team has worked together on it, but this would be the work that Jordan and I put into sort of the actual flow of how it's all going to work.
Okay. We see some other kind of lamps as well that we can describe later when we see the full group of lamps. But we're looking at a lot of other kind of bowls and just beautiful ware that look like they haven't been broken before.
Right.
Is that possible?
That's why we chose these, because they have been used, you can see.
Oh, very used, yeah.
It's rare for us to find complete vessels. Like once a week we get a complete vessel. Mm. 2,000 pieces of broken pottery every day we excavate, and once a week we get a whole vessel, something like that. So it's uncommon, but we chose the whole one because they would look better in the museum, of course.
Yeah.
But the first century items are really cool. You know, mirrors and fish hooks and arrowheads, medical instruments, bowls. This is like
I could have cereal, my morning cereal, out of this.
This
bowl
is my favorite, okay? Because it's the right size. You could have your cereal. Uh-huh. You could also have your coffee. I mean, it's sort of. If you were a bachelor, this is all you would need.
You would just need one thing. Just one thing. You just have to wash it all the time. That would be the problem.
Well, you would need to wash it if you were a bachelor.
Well, that's true. Okay. That's true.
These cook pots, I mean, look at the miniature one. You just need a little water for your tea or whatever, all the way up to large ones. One of our students there with the large one we were putting back together.
Now these don't have the same kind of collared top to them, these cook pots here.
No, these are first century. What we would call the classic Roman cook pot, and they would sit on top of an earthen oven that has a hole in the top of it. So the roasting is going on, the fire's down below, the hole is on top, these sit on top of it, and then the dough from the bread is thrown on the outside of the oven, the daily bread. So three things going on at once. You got the bread cooking on the outside, the cook pot on top, and then the roasting going on inside.
Inside. So you could, one fire doing three things at one time.
Yeah, it's very cool.
How would you describe the size of these? These look like maybe 6 inches tall, something like
all
that.
All sizes, though. See, here's the miniature. Uh-huh. There's the large, which is maybe 18 inches in diameter. So it's all the way from, say, 4 inches in diameter to 18 inches in diameter. Just like at home, you've got cook pots of all sizes. Uh-huh. They had them of all sizes, too.
As well. Yeah. Now, this looks like, to me, that it could be a feeding trough for animals. Is that possible?
Right. You're right. This is a manger. And this is a house that we excavated at Curva del Mercato, a first century, what we call a complex courtyard house. Notice how the animals live symbiotically. And this is a nice home, by the way.
Yeah.
They've got their animals here in their stable that's part of the house.
Yeah.
So later in the year, we're going to do a Christmas emphasis here in the exhibit, where we talk about the archaeology of Christmas and how it illuminates that story. Because there's some issues for the average Western reader when they're reading that text. Like Joseph's family wouldn't let his pregnant wife, 9-month pregnant wife, into the house because they got there first. And, you know, it just doesn't seem to add up with the whole hospitality culture. And so I think there's some clues in the text that archaeology helps illuminate. So.
Now, this looks like it's made out of stone.
This is made out of stone, and it's a beautiful bassinet. You just get the hay out of there, the water out of there, put a blanket in there, and you can lay the baby Jesus
right in there.
Yeah.
And this looks to be a little bit heavier than 50 pounds.
It's heavier than 50 pounds.
Yeah, I don't think you carried this out
this
by yourself.
This I had help with, I'll tell you that.
Now, what kind of stone is this?
Okay, this is a replica. And so this is limestone, but it has been sort of hewn here.
Cut here
in the U.S., but it is quite heavy.
Okay.
But this is very much what you would expect to see and what you do see in the ancient world.
It looks to be about 2.5 feet tall, something like that. I know it's sitting up on small blocks here today, but it's there. But, yeah, I could see a baby, an infant, lying in there.
And if you picture the manger, you can see where they go in the house. And so they just have to get the animals out of there. Of course, you have animals in the birth narrative. This is why.
It's sort of like the garage is attached to the house.
It's a combination barn house, right? And even the Old Testament, the four-room house, you've got the animals on the first floor and the humans on the second floor.
Right. And that was just very common in terms
of their sense of hygiene, just a little different from ours.
A little bit different. Yeah, a little bit different than ours. These look to be some of the coins, maybe, that you had here.
Well, here we have a series of faith lessons. And we talked earlier about the coins, how silver coins have great value and how that helps us understand Matthew 15, but each one of the artifacts in here, like an alabaster jar and a tear bottle and 30 pieces of silver, and this is where we talk to folks, depending on the length of the tour, but about different faith lessons and faith applications.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm looking at this. Is this an alabaster?
This is limestone. This is Jerusalem
limestone. Okay.
Limestone. It's carved out of one big chunk of limestone.
Okay. Now, what is this item? It looks like a big bread basket.
Big basin. And you can use it for a number of things, but the Mishnah gives us the exact dimensions for a foot bath in late Second Temple period times, and this is it.
This is the foot bath.
Could have been used for many things, but at least it does match those dimensions. And this vessel is an example of the ritual purity wave that swept through Judaism just before the time of Jesus, where they start using stone vessels. All these are stone, David, limestone.
Mm-hmm. So these have been cut out of rock.
Carved out of rock, either with a lathe or hand cut. Mm. That's not clay. Now, Leviticus 11 says, when your pottery becomes impure, says the Lord, you must break it.
Mm-hmm.
So they found a way to beat the system. It didn't say anything about stone vessels.
Right, make stone vessels, and that gets around it.
They
right?
perceived that these were not susceptible to ritual impurity. So these were preferred at Passover, Pentecost, Tabernacles, and so forth, because you couldn't transfer ritual impurity. And of course, they're very paranoid about this. In the New Testament, there's hand washing and foot washing and paranoia about ritual cleanliness. These are not susceptible to that. And so think of Jesus at the Last Supper, very likely used a cup like this.
So a stone cup rather than the Holy Grail like we've seen in some of the other
movies. If
they
just checked with an archaeologist, you know, before making the movie, we could have helped them, you know. But the quest for the Holy Grail, I think archaeology can show us what the cup of Christ looked like. Something like this, that core was with a lathe cut out of the center, and then see the cup here?
Yeah.
And there's a cup that's made out of the core.
Made out of the core.
Yeah.
So you could make two or three cups.
Make several things. And
like little nesting dolls coming out of the same cup.
It's exactly. What do the Russians call those? It's one doll inside of another. Anyway, there's a name for it.
Russian dolls.
And we had humans. This is, by the way, the classic Leger Fratensis, or 10th Roman Legion stamp on a clay tile. So this is on loan from another museum to us. We did not excavate that.
Wow, and what are those letters? I can see them.
L-E-X-F-R.
So
it's the 10th Legion Fratensis is what they called themselves.
Okay.
And when the Roman legions were not at war, they did civil service projects. You know, they built aqueducts and bridges and things like this, which I think is a great use of military when if we're not at war, but nobody's asked my opinion on this yet. But that seems to me like that's a good expenditure of tax dollars.
Sure, seems like it.
Yeah. Now, we found human skeletons among these vessels. Hmm. 8 human skeletons, 7 females and then a boy. And this was 69 AD. That's when all of our coins stopped. That's our carbon dates all point to this. Jerusalem is destroyed in 70. 1 year before, Kibbutz El Makadar, which I believe is biblical Ephraim, we'll show you in a minute what that looked like, was destroyed 1 year prior to that. These people were murdered. We found arrowheads embedded in their skeletal remains. We found tacks from military boots that were there. Their bodies were disarticulated.
And now, this means this was down in a cistern?
This was in an underground olive press cave.
So
it was a beautiful olive press cave that they repurposed as a hiding system during the Great Revolt. Okay. They had built a wall to block the entrance, but they were found. And the end of their lives must have been terrible. So for me, there's a lot of emotion when I see these objects. You know, you're touching that basin and this cup, and you know, I'm thinking about these were real people, you know, with feelings and emotions. Some of them may have met Jesus or encountered him, and they saw the Second Temple before it was destroyed, and the end of their lives were really, really horrific.
Yeah. We're looking at something pretty extraordinary here. Anything like it in archaeology so
nothing
far?
Nothing has ever been found like this. So it is a map of the city.
It's a map of which city?
Kibbutz El Makadar in New Testament times, late Second Temple period times, which we're going to look at on the other side. But this is what I believe was the village of Ephraim, John 11:34, where Jesus spent the last month of his life before the triumphal entry. We found this on this large, if you look down here at this picture, this massive stone. And we had finished the dig, we had done our drawings of the site, and then we found this. And we thought, you got to be kidding me. Someone 2,000 years ago had etched into a stone.
So we're looking at a piece of limestone here, right?
A massive piece, as that you can see.
I mean, but what we're looking at here is looks like about an inch and a half,
we
2 inches
cut it
wide.
Down. Right. So we cut it to that point, then we brought it back here and trimmed it down even more.
Wow.
And now it weighs about 25 pounds instead of 2,500 pounds.
Yeah.
And we can display
better.
It. But yeah.
So, and it looks like this is the outer wall here. Here's the line around the outside of the village. Is this a village or is this a city?
Let's call it a town.
Okay.
Village is smaller than a town. Town is smaller than a city. So technically to be a polis or a city, you've got to meet certain criteria. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we can call it a city, but it is well fortified. The houses that I was showing you, we excavated, like that house is right there.
And so
it's proportional to the things that we excavated also. So this will be on the cover of Kibbutz El Makadar Volume 2.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah. That's an amazing find.
Well, we always try to find parallels when we publish, you know, and there were no parallels.
There's no name either attached. The artist didn't leave his initials, did he?
It's also aggravating if they would have just done that.
Yeah, put Larson at the very bottom. You know, Gary Larson or something, I don't know.
Or Jacob or something.
Yeah.
And, of course, around Easter time, we're talking with folks about, you know, where was the tomb of Jesus? I just did an interview for a Jerusalem media outlet on that. You know, a lot of interest in the next few weeks about
right. Easter is a few weeks away. And we're looking here at a number of artifacts or facsimiles thereof.
Yeah, these are facsimiles, but these are what tools looked like in the first century. I was at Herodium.
Here's a wood mallet. Looking
yeah.
at a wood.
Let's check your reflexes on your knee right quick.
Oh, yeah. Break my knee really quickly.
It's pretty solid, though.
Yeah, but you could use that to hewn out these stones, right?
Yeah, if you've got an iron chisel, but you've got to hit the chisel with something,
right.
And this would be what you would hit it
what
with.
What you would.
Now, of course, the New Testament says that Jesus was a tecton.
Mm-hmm.
We translate that carpenter,
mm-hmm.
which the North American, of course, immediately equates to woodworking.
Mm-hmm.
But as we know, there's not much wood in that part of the world.
Right,
most
mainly
of the building
stone.
Is out of stone. So mm-hmm. it would be more accurate to think of Jesus as a builder or a mason. Mm-hmm. Not that he never worked with wood, but...
Yeah, well, because he would have in order to make some of these tools.
Yeah,
right?
So it existed, but not in the sense that we would think of a carpenter.
Right.
You know, building things here out of wood.
Everything's out of wood, exactly.
Yeah, so these tools are unique, and they can help us picture what Jesus did for a living when he's running a construction crew with his brothers in the 20s.
I'm looking here at an ossuary as well, or a facsimile of an ossuary. Would have been made out of limestone as well, right?
That's part of that ritual purity culture. So here's what happens in 100 AD. We start baptizing ourselves daily. We start using stone vessels, like we talked about. We begin to do secondary burial. Ossilegium, it's called. So now we're practicing this secondary burial. So those things are part of that wave of ritual purity. So we were not burying like this before 100 BC.
Mm.
So something changes around that time. So yes, they're cut out of limestone. Thousands of them have been found. This particular one, as you can see, has the name Caiaphas carved in the side of it. So this is a replica. And maybe the most famous ossuary that we have is... Jesus' brother, this is, you know...
James ossuary.
Yeah, most have come around to think that's an authentic
really?
Artifact.
Really? Okay, I haven't followed that lately.
Yeah, the pendulum swung, but I think everybody sort of feels that way now.
Maybe it could be.
James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus.
Right. Now, this is very ornate in terms of how it's been... most people would have had something much more simple.
Right.
But this is Caiaphas. Caiaphas is a pretty high-ranking
Money's
guy.
Money's no object. But it's always curious why the names are so haphazardly hewn in these beautiful ossuaries when they went to all this trouble. But
right. That's how they did it.
When you see the rosette, that's late Second Temple period. Very typical. We call these volutes and these rosettes. And when you see those, you know you're dealing with something from that time.
Now, this kind of burial did not go on for a long time, right?
I mean,
this kind of double burial.
AD 70, it begins to diminish, and by the turn of the century, certainly by the Bar Kokhba revolt, 132 to 135, it's no more. So 100 BC to 100 AD, that's your time window.
So maybe a 200-year period.
At the most.
And this is the kind of burial that Jesus' body would have had.
Had he stayed in the grave.
That's
exactly right.
And the size of this, I would say, I mean, this is a pretty good size ossuary.
This is bigger than most.
Right.
Usually they're only long enough for the femur bone.
Right. It has to be long enough for the largest bone of the body.
Which
right.
is the femur. So, yeah, usually, you know, this is maybe a good 6 inches longer than they normally mm-hmm. are.
There's enough of these in Israel that some people use them as flower pots. I mean, I've seen a number of them.
And they're worth a fortune now. You cannot even get them out of Israel to the United States anymore.
Oh.
So it's against the law. So, yeah, if they knew what they had, I think maybe they wouldn't do that. Remember when Jesus told the disciples, talk about the week of Passion, when you get into Jerusalem, he said, you're going to see a man carrying a jar of water. Follow him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, these are first century water jars. Mm-hmm. And we found them side by side. That's why I've got them like that. That's interesting for a couple of things. Number one, men didn't usually carry water.
Mm-hmm.
That was usually a woman's job. So if
right.
you see a man carrying a jar of water, it'll be easy to spot. He'll be the only one probably.
Yeah.
But think about Jesus' miracle of turning water into wine. John 2 says they were stone jars,
yeah.
not jars like
quite
this.
Large as well.
That's right.
The stone jars were large.
So like The Chosen, which has done a great job, I think, the series The Chosen, but they portrayed them as clay jars, you know, just little...
Oh, did they?
Yeah, they missed
okay.
it. Well, little details can just slip by us so easily, you know? So studying the material culture is fascinating.
Now, this is what do you call this? This is a replica, of course, but this is a stela or something like a stela?
similar to a stela, this is what we call the Nazareth inscription, because it was found in Nazareth. And most people would date this to Tiberius Caesar. Now, Jesus is born under Augustus and dies under Tiberius. We have both of their coins over here. And what this inscription says, quite fascinating, it's a decree of the death penalty for anyone who robs a grave in Palestine. Now, not throughout the Roman Empire, only in Palestine. So it seems there was a problem with bodies disappearing from graves in Palestine. And
so this might have been after the stories of the resurrection of Jesus.
This is entirely possible. Do you have a synchronism between the resurrection and, you know, the material culture? It's possible. Matthew 27:51 says that when Jesus came out of his grave, many others came out of their graves at the same time and were seen walking around the holy city. Do you have a reaction to that? And incidentally, here's the
crucifixion. There's got to be a law against that.
Well, robbing bodies, right? But what are you going to do with a body?
Right.
Who wants to rob a body, I mean, and risk crucifixion? I mean, we've got these crucifixion artifacts here. Yeah. I mean, who's going to risk their life when you've seen somebody crucified? Are you Victor Frankenstein? What are you going to do with this body?
Yeah,
anyway,
body snatchers. Now, is this nail, that looks like about a 5-inch nail, maybe?
I think
something
in
like
meters,
that.
So it's 12 centimeters.
So about 4 inches, a little over 4 inches.
Yeah. The four crucifixion victims that we have with nails still in them are this size. Okay, 10 and a half, 11 centimeters, but this style of nail. Not like what you expect from Byzantine art. So like the big spike nail right here, that's kind of what you would expect from Byzantine art.
Which looks almost like a railroad spike.
And that's kind of what we picture, because that's what we've seen in art. Another thing that the Byzantines did not do us any favor with was depicting Jesus with his feet overlapped where there are three nails.
Right.
Think of the country and western song, three rusty nails or whatever. It was actually four nails. And from the examples we have of crucified victims with nails still in them, the post is between the feet and the nails go from the outside in. One, two, three, four.
So not on the front of the cross, they're on the side of the
cross. That's right. Now, the Romans are barbarians. I'm sure if they were short of nails, maybe they did overlap somebody's feet. But the one examples we have is this type of nail, and there's four, not three. Yeah. And you can see the a spear, a first century spear, and kind of picture, again, Jesus having his side pierced, a toga pin, what we would call a fibula, from the first century. Jesus' garment would have been held with something like that. And the soldiers, after the crucifixion, are fighting over who gets his clothing. So apparently he's wearing pretty nice clothing. The whole idea that he's a Galilean peasant seems problematic when everybody's arguing over who gets his clothing. And this is a first century die. You know, we excavate lots of...
It's a lot smaller than I thought.
Well, they're of all sizes. You know, we've got beautiful ones that are made of lapis lazuli and different things, but this is just a simple wooden die, and you can picture the soldiers, 20-year-olds or whatever, at the foot of the cross, and they're gambling over the clothing of Jesus. And, of course, then this is, everything in there is real except the whip, which is a replica. Most men did not survive the beating, okay? Jesus is in the prime of life. He's very vigorous. He does. Women were never beaten, by the way, and were never crucified. Only Roman citizens were beheaded. That's a gentleman's death. Non-citizens...
More quickly. So it's quicker.
It's over. The point of this is to prolong it as much as you possibly can.
Inflict
so
as much
non-citizens
suffering.
Or people charged with sedition or whatever that would be crucified.
So this is similar to the spear that might have pierced Jesus' side. It's made out of bronze. It looks like it's about 8 to 10 inches in length or longer.
Yeah, maybe 12 inches in length. And it's a little dull now, but I'm sure that it was sharp at the time that it was being used. Yeah, it just sort of gives us that picture of what this may have looked like when Jesus' side was pierced.
Yeah. The nail that we're looking at here in the museum is called a square nail. Why is it called that?
This is one of the ways that we differentiate modern nails from ancient nails, is that the shaft is square and that the head is square. So this is very typical of what you would expect to see of a first century nail. Go to a site that's very dry, like Herodium. When I was in Herodium 2 years ago, just before the country closed, they had just opened up the new part that had been buried. And I was one of the first ones to go in there with the archaeologist. David, the wood, the beams, 2,000-year-old beams, because Herod built it. It's 2,000 years old. Looks like they were built last week. The nails are perfectly preserved because there's no moisture. Very dry. And so we have lots of examples of these nails from that time period. And so it's a whole typology of the nails. Mm. But the key diagnostic is square shaft, square head.
And this has been made out of iron?
Yes.
Out of iron. Now, it's curved here pretty significantly.
Okay.
Almost pulled not quite out. 90 degrees.
Imagine when the nail was pulled out of something, and then that's why it's bent. So it would have been straight originally.
It would have been straight originally, but being pulled out of the wood, just like we would bend a nail pulling it out of wood.
That's right. And even crucifixion victims. So when they're taken off of the cross after they have been nailed, and they're tied also, because that won't keep the body on the cross. So they also tie them on there to prolong the suffering. Well, then they're going to try to recycle the nails. So they pull them out, and when they pull them out, they'll bend like this.
Some of them inevitably are going to bend.
And some of them end up getting stuck into the wood, like a knot in the wood or something like that, and then they leave them in the crucifixion victim. That's the famous one of Yohanan, has his name on his ossuary, and the nail is still in him, in his ankle, and what it had done, it had like hit a knot, and they just left it in there.
And they've discovered those as far away as Britain.
Recently.
Very recently.
Very recently in Britain, that's right, second century.
So they were crucifying victims in Roman Britain.
If you were not a citizen, then you were subject to crucifixion.
Yeah. Yep. Now we're looking at some bowls here that look like they have some writing in the bottom of them.
That's Aramaic.
That's biblical Aramaic?
It's a couple of centuries later. This is probably 5th century Aramaic. So we're now into the Byzantine section of the museum.
Okay.
And it's often the last artifact that folks look at, but it helps them understand magic and how people looked at the supernatural world. And on bowl one, you can see a demon's picture there in the middle of the bowl, and circles that are descending down, binding this demon. Usually they have spells. Some of them even have the name of Jesus on the spell. In the name of Beelzebub, in the name of Isis, in the name of Jesus of Nazareth, like anyone with power.
Anybody you think that might have some power to help you.
That's right. Throw a little salt over your shoulder.
Now, when you say magic, we think a lot of times of illusions and tricks that a magician does.
Right.
But that's not exactly
this magic is more means. Of folk magic. It's how do you deal with the spirits, okay? In Latin culture, you would talk about curanderismo, or in the voodoo culture, how they dealt with the supernatural world. So they're trying to deal with demons here.
They're trying to manipulate these powers, aren't they? Trying to do things to stop them or to...
I'm under the assumption the reason bad things are happening to me is because someone's cast a spell on me. Okay? So now I got to counter that in some way. And so I'm going to capture that demon. These bowls are always found upside down. 4,000 of them have been found. They're always upside down. So they're capturing the demon, then placing it upside down. Now, Dr. Craig Evans and I published these two bowls 2 or 3 years ago in a Near East Archaeological Society bulletin, and the study was very interesting because it is Aramaic, but notice how this one is in quadrants and that one is circular. Okay, that's Aramaic script, but it says nothing. It's gibberish.
It looks like it's some of the same letters over and over again.
Repeated, it's gibberish. Yeah. And what we determined, to make a long story short, and what we published... if folks know what glossolalia is, speaking in tongues, that this was an example of glossographia, writing in tongues. They are attempting to confuse these demons and then to bind them through glossographia. And that was our conclusion.
Oh, wow. I should have read that article before we did this.
And that will be in our museum booklet. Our booklet that will be out in a couple of weeks that folks can get for only $10. It has 3 articles in it, one of them on this. And then all the artifacts in there with pictures and explanations.
Now, this exhibit opened March 1st, 2022. How long will the exhibit be here?
We will have it open through the end of the year.
And from here, where does it go?
Well, it's either going to Colorado Christian University or Emmaus Bible College, or if they don't finalize that relationship, someone else who's listening to this podcast can contact me about it.
You never know. Might be in South America, might be in Africa. You never know. Scott, thanks for your time today. Dr. Scott Stripling, we appreciate you spending this time with us, sharing with you some great gems from the work that you've been doing all these years.
So thrilled that I got to do it.
That ends part 2 of our conversation with Scott Stripling at the 3J exhibit. It's on display in Houston, in the Houston area, at the Bible Seminary throughout the year 2022. Now, beyond that, it'll be in another city. Perhaps that'll be near you. I want to thank Janet Seifert and Kathy Cates for helping us produce this podcast. Always give thanks for Phil Kagi for his great music through the years, and particularly on this podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to the Stone Chapel on your favorite podcast platform. Tell a friend about us, please, and thanks for listening.